and welcome back to the Naughty Web Council. I am your host, Rillian, and today we have Glumpuddle with us. Glumpuddle, welcome back.
Back again, with just a couple weeks to go now. It's insane.
Indeed. This will most likely, I would not be surprised if this is the last podcast before the movie comes out. Maybe we'll be able to get another one in, but this is probably going to be our thoughts before. The next time you talk to us, we'll probably have seen the film.
Very possibly. I think we are kind of getting to that point to where, you know, in a few weeks, the only thoughts, the only reviews, the only reaction that really matters is going to be online, which is, of course, our reactions to the final film. Like, you know, who needs speculation? Who needs anticipation when you've got the film right in front of you? All that just kind of goes out the window.
Right. So, really, we're just going to talk about, the last trailer, which I think is technically the fourth trailer.
I think officially it is the fourth trailer.
Counting any really short spots or anything. Actually, there was one spot I saw that did not have the White Witch at all, and I was just, oh, I was so happy.
That must have been exciting.
It was. I was like, yes!
Maybe she won't be there.
Yeah, I'm hoping again. It was just a really good looking spot. You know, nothing wrong with it. Anyway.
Yeah.
We're gonna kind of run through the latest trailer. Not a whole lot of nitpicking, but we're gonna talk about some issues that we see, and some kind of just some questions hey, is this misleading? Is this gonna be a problem? And then just talk about our overall thoughts for the film. And if some of you are wondering, hey, why isn't Jim Fan with them to balance off Glumpuddle and Rillian?
Well, why would that be?
Well, maybe it's because Jim Fan got to see the movie early. And so,
and Jim Fan, overall, I'm very, very afraid of spoilers at this point, which is why I haven't watched most of the clips even.
That's true. But I have not seen any of the clips. I've just decided to avoid them at this point.
And especially if there's not going to be another podcast before the movie comes out, I just assume stay pretty spoiler-free. But anyway, without giving any away, Jim Fan overall seemed to really like it, and which is one of the reasons why, even though there's some bad stuff in this trailer, I'm kind of thinking, well, I don't know. Maybe this trailer is just that misleading, which is kind of what we're going to talk about. So I'm feeling like, man, I might be surprised and like this movie because I really respect Jim Fan's opinion.
And she basically said she admitted there's bad things in there, but she said the good definitely outweighed the bad. And so
And she talked about how, you know, like Hollywood keeps trying to throw in all their epicness and special effects and all that, but nonetheless, the heart of the story still shines through.
Yeah, well, so we'll see. I'll just have to – I mean, at this point, one of the reasons I'm not watching any more clips is just because watching a trailer before a movie doesn't really take away the specialness of certain moments before a film the way a whole clip will. And so even if a super trailer comes out, I'm not going to watch it. I'm just going to say, hey,
definitely
it's
not.
Just a little bit more time. All right. So basically, jumping in, we have the ending –
at the beginning.
I don't know if they saw the Harry Potter trailer and said, hey, let's do the same thing.
Ah.
Sorry.
It's true, and that's one thing that Minotaur talks – oh, and by the way, if you want the true, definitive kind of shot-by-shot, what are the implications of all this, and also just really entertaining and insightful – Minotaur for Aslan's analysis is the place to be. His YouTube channel is called A Minotaur's Journey, and I've also favorited it on my YouTube channel. My YouTube channel is GPuddle. I favorited that. It's just really like I really like the way he goes about breaking down every shot, and it's just also a lot of fun if you're a fan.
Yeah.
But anyway, and that's one of the things he mentions is that they've given it all away.
Yeah.
Here at the beginning.
Yeah, it was a pretty funny little analysis, but yeah, I was actually kind of surprised to see that. But you know, basically, we do have one thing I will just throw out there. I kind of like how Aslan is making the portal. I presume to our world, not to his country.
This is pretty much as described in the book. The book does kind of talk about that wave. It's a little bit different, and I like the portal too. I think the book talks about there being like an opening in the sky or something like that, which is kind of hard to visualize. Well, like it works great when you think about it in the book, but what does that actually look like to open the sky? So I think this is kind of achieving the power of that without having to actually do literally that. I think it's pretty awesome and spectacular. Just really cool idea, I think.
Yeah, in the book it just says, all in a moment there was a rending of the blue wall, like a curtain being torn, and a terrible white light from beyond the sky. So, visually, I think this is a good way of working it.
Yeah, one of the main things people are also talking about is Aslan's shadow here. And when it shows Aslan's shadow, that's how he enters the scene. And there's some people have tried to speculate that maybe this is the lamb to lion transformation. This is how they're going to do it, kind of like Professor McGonagall in the first Harry Potter movie. I mean, and that's not what it is, for the record. I got to see this in this little 30-second clip here screened. And I'll just say that's not what it is. All it is it shows them walking past. Then the camera kind of pans down to their shadows, and their shadows exit the frame. Then Aslan's shadow enters the frame, and that's how he's introduced in the scene. So it's a really cool kind of seamless way to introduce him. But there's some people thinking, oh, is this where they're going to have the lamb in there? No, this is not the place. If they're going to include it, which I don't think they are.
Yeah. Well, I mean, overall, I think I'm – even with Caspian being there, I think I'm going to really like The World's mm-hmm. End. I have one big question, which is as far as the reason he brought them into to Narnia, and if he asks them, hey, I'm going to let you – come – if you want, you can come to Aslan's country. It seemed – if that's actually an option there, I'm going to have some issues. But
yeah,
overall,
that doesn't seem to make sense. It's like the reason he brought them to Narnia was that by knowing me for a little better here, you might know me better there. So
right.
It's like, well, if that's his whole reason, why would he give them the option of going to Aslan's country? That would defeat the entire purpose of bringing them to Narnia in the first place. So that there's got to be a missing piece here. There's something
we
don't know yet.
And hopefully we actually have that line, which it sounds like a lot of the dialogue is from the book. And so it looks like we might have that line, so that you might know me better there. It's not
I think we might have to avoid reading the comments for this podcast, because I know that is one of the clips that is online, is some really key lines from this scene mm-hmm. that I have not watched.
Yeah.
That's definitely the one scene you cannot pay me to watch that scene.
So take pride, everyone. You might know more about the film than we do.
Yes, this is the trailer, and that's it. You brought up Caspian being there, and there's one shot, if you go to right at the 19-second mark, where Caspian looks, he's like he's walking a lot further ahead than the others. So is this going to be him saying, no, I want to go. Reavy Cheap, come back. I want to come. Or something like that. It just seems like Caspian's going to have a really emotional moment in this scene, is what it seems like.
Yeah, we have that one close-up of him. But, yeah, I don't know. Hard to say.
Mm-hmm.
Great shot of the Dawn Treader, I'll just say.
Yeah.
It's
epic.
Great. Yeah, epic. Okay, the dragon shot.
The dragon. The eye opening is really neat. We see the reflection of the lion coming towards him.
Mm-hmm. I just, some people say, oh, I don't like how the dragon looks in this scene. I just don't like these two shots, the one of the dragon and the one of Aslan.
And this really brings us to, I think, one of the, if you glance through the thread on this, this is the one of the main issues people are talking about is the fakiness. And I think the majority opinion is that the visual effects, overall, they look good. There's just a couple shots that kind of make people cringe.
Mm-hmm.
And people kind of disagree on which ones they are. But I think the two shots that everyone seems to agree on are the dragon and Aslan here. That they just don't look right.
I have to say, as far as a real, and if I were to pick an official trailer for this movie, I would say it was the third trailer that we got. This is the one that Apple picked for their website to say, yes, this is the full trailer, And it just, it seemed kind of rushed, kind of, put together poorly. I don't know. So it may be that these were from earlier shots or something. I don't know. Funny is that the shots immediately following are photographed, Cambridge and the islands, and I thought it looked so realistic. It was kind of jarring. It just took me out of the moment. Whoa, it looks real.
Yeah.
And let's just not even talk about, we have some lame narrating here with enemies will unite, and we know that that's misleading.
Enemies will unite. I remember a couple of Narnia Webbers have posted, I don't think I've read a single post that likes the narrator. It's just been like, a couple people said, I just kind of tuned out the narrator and just ignored it because it's all lies.
Yeah. Now, if I could ask quickly, the shots of the Dark Island and everything have kind of, they've changed a bit as we've seen the effects go on. What do you think of how it's looking right now, just visually?
Well, you're totally right. We've kind of seen the shots kind of evolve. This one here at the 59-second mark especially, the kind of Raiders of the Lost Ark kind of shot. The first trailer, I really didn't like it. I look at this, it definitely looks better, at least. It's a little creepier because it's darker, for one thing. It is the Dark Island. I guess I just would have preferred that it just be just pitch black you know, and that we would only hear things and not see them. I think that would have been creepier. But this definitely looks – I like the kind of foggy kind of look to it, I guess. I guess this definitely looks better than what it looked like in the first trailer, yeah. That's for sure.
Well, if you go to the 102 mark, it does look more menacing, which I like. And I was kind of wondering if just a pitch black – here's what I did not want. I did not want a mist or a fog because that would – I mean, if you're going to do a fog, I guess this is the way you would do it. I wanted it to be almost like a black hole effect, where it's just like just an uncanny, unnatural darkness that just absorbs the light around it. That, you know, almost
it steals the light from this world. You mean? Gotcha.
Yeah.
But I mean, it is a really tricky thing to visualize, I think, because the book, I think the book actually says it was not strictly speaking a mist. It was a darkness where you could see the light, and then I think he makes a comparison of being like looking down a railroad tunnel, like the light just ends. And that's a really hard thing, I think, to visualize.
Yeah.
And so you can see where them kind of wanting to make it more of a mist is kind of understandable.
Yeah, especially to show off on the new, you know, HD screens and everything. Ooh, look at us, 3D. Yeah. We can't just have blackness.
Ooh, mist went past.
It's not a 3D blackness. It needs to be 3D, so we'll do fog. Okay, real quickly, I just have kind of a question. When he says, that sword you carry, at first I thought it was Rinden, but it's not. And I'm guessing he's wearing one of the swords of the Seven Lords.
Which is a little odd. I think we did hear about that, actually. Like, Lord Byrne gives it to him, and Edmund seems all excited about it. Or maybe not, wasn't Lord Byrne. One of the lords gives it to Edmund, or something like that. It is, like, why would he be wearing it as a little bit odd?
Mm-hmm. But, yeah.
It is a pretty cool rack focus in that shot.
It is. I mean, it's good.
107 mark.
A lot of these shots, I mean, the shots of the Lone Islands, it looks, you know, a lot of this stuff looks really good.
Yeah, the Lone Islands looks just how I pictured it. That wide shot at 108 is like just how I pictured it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, there are some the shots in this trailer that show the least CG just look fantastic, in my opinion.
They look good. There's still kind of, I don't know, a sense of life that's kind of missing. And I could not quite put my finger on it until I read a post from, was from Saver 100. And he was saying that he thought maybe it was because they shot it. I think it was he. They said they shot it digitally. And which I didn't really connect those two. I've been saying, oh yeah, I think digital makes things look kind of fakey and shooting digitally as opposed to on film. Do you think that could be the reason why there just seems to be this overall kind of fakiness to everything? Now, some people disagree with that, though. Some people don't think it looks fake. And I guess what I would also ask is, is this kind of fakiness, is maybe what we're actually seeing here is an intentional artistic decision by Apted to make things a little more dreamlike? What do you think about that?
I don't know. I do think that this film looks very clean. And when I say clean, I mean, there's not really any distortion in what you're seeing, which I guess is kind of a style. I mean, I don't know. One of the things that kind of makes everything sometimes,
especially when there's a lot of visual effects, it just makes everything seem kind of almost like a pop-up book.
Yeah, whenever I see a movie that sometimes when things look, you know, sometimes when things look blurry, they look fake, but sometimes when they look too crisp, they look fake.
Yeah.
You know, because we're kind of used to, even in life, you know, things kind of blurring by at certain speeds. And I don't know if the digital records blurriness the same way. I'm inclined to think that it doesn't capture a blurry notion. And maybe it's – I kind of wonder if this transition to digital is maybe it's our eyes are just kind of untrained at some of this stuff.
It could be, yeah. And it definitely – I mean, there's a lot – Don Trader had a lower budget, and it just seems to me that one of the main attractions to it was that, oh, this is going to cost us less.
Yeah.
So that makes me say it wasn't necessarily an artistic decision. It was more of a budgetary constraint. But then again, I will say that if the decision really is to make Narnia a little more dreamlike, just a couple steps more towards that Wizard of Oz kind of world where it's not really real. And again, I don't think they're going completely that direction, but just another step kind of in that direction.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I wouldn't like that. And I just wonder if maybe the fans who like all these visual effects shots, maybe they're okay with that idea of Narnia being a little more dreamlike, whereas I'm not. I mean, I loved what Andrew Adamson said about the first two films, how he said There's a quote from him. He said that Narnia is an alternative reality. It's a somewhat idealized reality, but it's real, it's physical, it exists. And I thought the first two films found a pretty good line there of, yeah, this is definitely a fairy tale just by looking at it, but it has a physical credibility at the same time. And I'm not seeing that in Dawn Treader so far. Maybe the fans who aren't bothered by these visual effects, maybe if you ask them about it, they don't mind Narnia being a little more dreamlike, whereas I do. Yeah. Maybe that's kind of what's happening here.
Yeah, and I think actually, in many ways, Prince Caspian captured the reality of Narnia the best of the two. It made it feel the most real, and I guess
it was trying to contrast wardrobe with the brutal reality, the loss of the fairy tale.
Right. No, but I'm not talking about just that. I mean, just in general, just the way it was shot, the way it was. But I think you could have, in some ways, had that same kind of realism, and then thrown in the whether it's the spirits of the trees or Aslan or the fauns or I felt like even that one had a more – I felt like it was – did a better job than Wardrobe at saying this is an alternative reality. Grittiness and brutality aside and loss of magic aside.
I would say I think Wardrobe was, it was kind of more leaning towards the fairy tale side, but again, had a three-dimensional physical credibility. Like that Minotaur is really there and he could hurt you. And with Prince Caspian, I think they just took another step towards realism because they were trying to emphasize that the fairy tale world of Narnia had been driven away and was dying and now it had to be restored.
Okay, fair
enough. So I think that's a case where I think it was an intent. It's not that they were doing a better job of something. It was that it was a very intentional artistic decision to make Prince Caspian seem more real because it was more appropriate for the theme of the story. And here it seems like they're taking even more fairy tale-ish than Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, making it kind of dreamy and not quite real.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll have to see at the end of the film, but
you got to see the final shot.
Yeah, now the because a couple lines. I mean, the line from Reepy Cheep. I cringe.
Nothing.
I cringe.
Belief.
Yeah, we have nothing if not belief. I cringed at this line more than I did the line with from Lily Andel. Because that one just kind of thought, that's cheesy. But here I just thought, this was the one that actually got to me more, personally.
Well, that's fine. And we're in the minority here. I think a lot of Narnia lovers really seem to like that line. I've looked through and no one really seems to explain why they like it. It's not that I dislike it. I'm just kind of confused by it. Like, well, wait, what does that mean? We have nothing if not belief. Like, what exactly is Reepy Cheep getting at here? And again, this is thrown out of context in a trailer, so it could mean a lot of things.
I mean, I guess it's not so much just that I hate the line. It's rather that it just seemed like something Reepy Cheep wouldn't really say. Reepy Cheep is actually, he makes himself clear, and to say we have nothing if not belief, it seems like something, like some little soundbite that some guy would just put in there, like some pastor would put in their thing, trying to be hip and cool and,
for a bumper sticker.
Here, it looks like something like that. And I guess it just didn't seem like something Reepy Cheep would say.
And again, should emphasize, it seems like we're kind of in the minority here. Now, I don't dislike the line. I just don't really understand what it means.
Maybe
it'll make sense in the final film.
I mean, maybe it'll make sense in the final film. I mean, it just jumped out at me because, A, I didn't know. It just seemed vague. B, it didn't seem like something Reepy Cheep would say.
Kind of like return to hope on the trailer.
Right.
It's kind of vague. Like, well, what does that mean?
If I had heard it the same line from Puddleglum, then I probably would, because that's actually more in line with his character at the very end, where he says, I would rather live in a fake Narnia than in your. It seems like the imaginary worlds are better than the real ones.
I thought of that.
I don't know. That's just why it just jumped out at me. But can I say.
Well, now, we got to talk about the real issue soon here, which is Lucy's line right before that.
Right.
That's
yeah.
The big issue.
What do you think about that?
Well, what we have here is we hear Reepy Cheep say "Ascent Country," and then Lucy says, "Do you really believe there's such a place?" Which implies that she's questioning the existence of Aslan's country. And there's some division on this on the thread as well. You see some fans there's a few fans who really think it's awful. It's blasphemy. Like, how could she question the existence of Aslan's country? Then I think most of the people who like it are just kind of like, well, maybe it doesn't quite mean what it seems like it means in the trailer. Do I like it? Well, I don't necessarily like it, but I don't think I necessarily have a problem with it either. And I could see where it could be good. It could, in the book, it's more about, well, of course Ascend Country exists, but is it the kind of place you could sail to is really the mm-hmm. question. That's where the uncertainty and the mystery comes from. In the movie, maybe they've just changed it more to, is it even there at all? And I can see potentially where that could make the anticipation, it could actually enhance it where that much more. It could emphasize the longing for Ascend Country and is it going to be there? Oh, yes, it's there. You know, the joy of that. So do I like this? Not necessarily, but I can see where it has potential to be a good thing.
I don't really see potential for it being a good thing. I guess I just see potential that it might not have that much of an impact cognitively on the audience. Because for one thing, when I just think of, okay, who would say that? Lucy, I think, would be the last person who would say that. Well, actually, okay, well, second to last. Maybe Ripichi would be the last person who would say that. But I think that, you know, it says something about Lucy and her understanding of who Aslan is. Okay, granted, in the films, we don't have the Emperor Beyond the Sea. You know, that's something that's entirely omitted. And you know, some fans might raise more of an issue about that than others. But I think here I think in the book, there was an understanding Aslan is real. He might not work the same way that we do as far as, you know, being limited to one place at a time or things like that. And also, his home is real. He has a place where he, which is really his own place. It is just as real as anything else, even if we might not be able to physically access it. That's where I think the mystery kind of came in. And I think that there was a real understanding. Well, yes, he has a home that is just as real as anywhere else, but it's not necessarily that same kind of physical reality that our home is.
Okay, but you have some good points in there. I mean, all in all, it's like I can definitely nitpick this sort of 10-second section of the trailer here and say, well, I don't really like Reap's line, and I'm not sure how I feel about Lucy questioning the existence of Aslan's country. But ultimately, what I walk away from this part of the trailer is that this 10 seconds in the trailer is probably as good as I've felt about this film as any other time in the past several months. Just because for me it was like, you know, nitpicking aside, for 10 seconds there, it felt like a Voyage of the Dawn Treader movie to me. Hmm. It felt like, you know, that they were talking about the excitement of Aslan's country. Are we going to get there? I felt the sense of anticipation, excitement, longing for Aslan's country. And I remember, I actually, when I was watching the trailer for the first time, I wanted to go back and watch that again because I'm like, wow, for 10 seconds, it felt like I was watching a trailer for C.S. Lewis's The Voyage of the Dawn Treader. So all in all, nitpicking aside, I kind of felt encouraged by this part of the trailer.
Hmm. Well, I didn't necessarily feel encouraged by it, but I will say that I don't see it as something that will necessarily, you know, derail anything. I think it could just be something that, as you know, what do you walk away with? Yeah, when you're looking back on the film, you know, that little moment, it doesn't really, you know, make a huge difference. Maybe
it's my favorite part of the trailer. It's again just where the part I really felt for a moment encouraged by it, and then you remember all the Seven Swords thing and. And then you got the bit with Lily Undle again later on. But still, that bit right there I really liked. And I hope that the 10 seconds is more a reflection of the final film than the other, you know, 2 minutes and 3 seconds in this trailer.
Okay, quick question. At around the 127 mark, are these naiads? These aren't mermaids. What are they, do you think?
I don't know. Like that showed up in the first trailer, and it's been in other previews as well. They don't look like sea people unless they've changed. Have they taken the sea people out and said they put in naiads or something like that? And that's just one of those things where in other trailers, I just kind of mentally blocked it out because I'm like, well, I have no idea, so move on. You know, I have no thoughts. I just don't know.
Yeah.
I don't suppose I would – I guess that would be kind of unfortunate to cut out the sea people, but, you know, they're just – much bigger issues I'm kind of worried about right now.
I am glad that they have the obvious freshwater joy of Reepy Cheep. I mean, that's just something that's I'm really glad to see.
So you're talking about when he jumps in by Eustace?
Yeah. I'm not sure
what this is. Like, what do you think we're looking at here?
I'm not sure what Eustace is doing in there, but it looks like, I mean, Reepy Cheep's got to be excited about the fresh water.
I thought that for a second. Are you meaning the drinkable light when, or the sweet water is what you're talking
about,
right?
Sweet water, yes.
Yeah. Now, my thought here, notice the side of the ship is damaged at 131. My thought here is that maybe this is after the Dark Island is destroyed, which we don't know if that's going to happen because, you know, it depends on which version of the book you read. But maybe this is the Dark Island being destroyed, and Eustace has brought the story back to them or something, and he's undragoned, and he's in the water, you know, kind of like in the book when he's undragoned while he's in the water. It's kind of a baptism kind of imagery going on there.
Well, I think it is right after he's undragoned. I think it's right after.
Yeah, and so then – so this is maybe Eustace kind of comes up for air, and maybe that's the first time we see him as a boy or something like that. I don't know. I think that would kind of contradict some other reports we've heard. But by the way, my feeling is that this is just after he's undragoned and probably just after the destruction of the Dark Island and Reaper Jeep is jumping in. Maybe this is also the moment where he discovers the sweet water. So it could be all these things at once.
Okay. We don't have to discuss the Liliando line because we've already discussed it ad nauseum. But I will say, I showed this trailer. One of my friends, who is a huge Narnia fan, grew up with the books. She's very disconnected from the movie, or at least the Narnia web movie community. And so she had not seen any of the trailers. I showed her this line, and she was just kind of, you know, nodding her head as she watched the trailer. And then that one line came up, and she gagged. So just throwing that out there.
No, it just seems wrong to me. It just seems like the... Also, I didn't really get a lot of chance to discuss this because I wasn't part of the trailer analysis. It's just the book is so much more subtle about this, where Romandu's daughter, or RD as I call her, kind of tells him what the deal is. And then Caspian says, you know, in my world, there's a story where the prince had to kiss the princess to dissolve the enchantment. And then Romandu's daughter says, here it's different. Here you have to dissolve the enchantment before kissing the princess. When I read that the first time, to me, it felt like he wasn't even necessarily saying, oh, I want to do this so I can kiss you. It was like kissing the princess was the equivalent of the thing you have to do. Because he was drawing a comparison between this story and another fairy tale. But again, it plants the seed in the reader's mind of maybe there's something there. And then obviously at the end of that chapter, there's a kind of a stronger implication that maybe there's something there. Either way, it's much more nuanced and subtle. This seems clumsy and heavy-handed.
Yeah, it's much more, you know, in the book. Here, it's like... Hey,
yeah,
you know,
yeah, exactly.
They like
wrap you on the head, like, yeah. Oh, they're in love. You think she's hot, you know? In the book, it's a little more subtle, and also we don't even see them get married. We just kind of know what happened, you know?
Okay, for one thing, okay, and I have to. I'm just kind of moving forward here with certain shots. The shot at 1:45 of Susan and Peter, and
oh my word, another one.
Which hey, this one I'm not. I'm just confused by it, but I'm not really alarmed by, because they're not in Narnia, okay?
Right. Like, this is by far the least alarming shot.
So I'm kind of confused. I'm also kind of confused about why the man on their left is looking at them with Agent Smith sunglasses.
They're Secret Service. Narnian kings and queens have Secret Service for the rest of their lives, just like U.S. presidents.
I don't know. What do you think is going on? Is this the ending?
Well, you know, again, there's basically two theories, I think, that are out there. This is either the beginning of the film, or it's a flashback in the middle of the film. I guess there aren't really any other options.
I guess it's that.
My guess would be that there's something to do with the magician's book flashback or something or other. I think there was some notion that, like, Lucy, like, sees herself as Susan, where she's kind of, seeing a vision of herself as Susan. And you can see where it seems like Susan seems very dolled up here, you know, makeup's kind of overdone, you know. So maybe either way, I think this is part of the magician's book scene somehow, like some kind of flashback or vision or dream or something.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's a military. There's a man in it looks like a Navy uniform behind them to Edmund's right. There's another man in what looks like an Army uniform. So, you know, there is an Army and it looks like a Royal Air Force uniform. So I don't know. It's some kind. I wonder if this has some kind of connection. That alone makes me think it's maybe towards the beginning, maybe with Edmund trying to sign up. I don't know.
I mean, either way, this shot is so unbelievably out of place in this trailer. it's showing Lucy walk through the invisible house, and then Coriacum becoming visible.
The music
shot,
is odd.
And then the Dawn Treader.
The music is odd. You know, like the bing, you know, the bell tone from when he collapses. And then the music dying down for the stupid Liliando joke. I don't know. This just isn't that well put together a trailer.
It's just, and again, you can feel like this is what I guess the way that we're being presented with the shots of Peter and Susan in the trailer, and I guess maybe even the White Witch, is what makes me concerned. It's and again, we know they're going to have small roles, so I don't think it'll be that bad, right. But why do they have these small roles? Is it because they were writing the script and realized, you know, it would be really great to have Peter and Susan here. That would work. Or did they just decide, well, we have to find a place to squeeze them in, whether it works or not, because we want to include them in the trailer. And because that'll be a good, you know, marketing thing. And so I'm just – this seems so out of place. This shot could not be any more different from everything else in the trailer. This is like – I think there's only like two or three shots in this whole trailer that are actually in our world, in England. And everything else is Narnian. So this just seems so out of place. This yeah. Fox, again, trying to mislead you, squeeze in something that is not true.
Yeah. We'll just have to see. It'll be interesting to see where this comes in. What's funny is how Will looks the exact same age. He's got to be about 20.
Oh, there was some discussion. I think it was that shot, by the way, of Peter and Susan, that Edmund kind of looks like he has a mustache. I think it's probably just the shadow. I don't think he really has a mustache.
Yeah, it's a shadow.
Yeah, but the very next shot is a shot that everyone seems to like, and Fantasia Kitty especially liked, of the Dawn Treader, and there's kind of a blood-red sunset.
The light sun.
And that's pretty neat-looking.
That's a neat shot.
Yeah, you really see the current kind of coming towards the camera. That's a neato shot. We've seen a lot of really cool kind of wide tracking shots of the Dawn Treader.
And now is the time to be
and
strong.
This next shot,
cheer!
Yeah, a lot of people, like as I've mentioned, it seems like Caspian's actually going to be a credible, strong leader, which a lot of people felt like he wasn't in Prince Caspian, which maybe that was kind of the point. But like this just seemed like maybe he'll be a stronger leader in this one. People seem to be reacting positively to that,
which would
be good. He's a king now, you know, been king for a few years.
If Barnes can pass that off, it'd be great because it's a big development for his character.
Mm-hmm. At 1:49, what is Koryakin throwing?
It looks like snow.
Is it snow? Or water, or pixie dust, or I don't know what. It's weird. Well, what's he doing?
I don't know.
Either way, the cinematography looks pretty awful, I think. That just looks like they ran out of lights that day, and we're trying to make it look like the sun. I think that looks pretty fakey. Not fakey CG.
Right,
fakey
right.
As in it doesn't look natural.
I don't think there's much CG in this shot, actually. I think that's just, yeah.
Yeah.
Well...
We have to talk about the next shot of the Duffelpuds too, even though it's brief and you can't tell anything. Again, I want to like, what do you think of them? I guess
I didn't expect them to be quite so acrobatic, but
really, how come? They seem pretty acrobatic in the book.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe
about all the jumping around
the
and
backflips. I mean,
yeah, I guess.
I'm not saying it can't work. I'm just saying it kind of took me by surprise.
And it's a tough thing. I mean, there was a recent interview with Michael Apted where he basically said that the Duffelpuds were considering the amount of screen time they had, maybe they spent more. You think he said we spent more money on them than they were worth, like considering the amount of time they're on screen. But at least he made the decision to keep them in there. Mm-hmm. And he could tell reading the interview, he knew, you got to have the Duffelpuds in there.
Yeah,
but they're obviously really, really hard characters to do. I mean, they're one-footed small creatures hopping around. Making that look real is a huge challenge. But I hope they look better than this. I'll just say that. If you go to 151, there's that shot that looks like they're at the Lone Island, and everyone's, like, cheering them on and stuff, which is good because it makes it look like that maybe that kind of fake parade they do, maybe that will make it into the film in some form, even though I'm not sure what Lucy is doing there. I guess she's already been freed.
I guess...
So that's exciting because it sounds like they're gonna have a big action scene at the Lone Islands, which is just wrong.
Right.
The whole point is that they escape by not fighting, but at least that kind of parade, which is so great in the book, will be there in some form.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see. I don't know how that'll play out. I just have to kind of see it. I reserve judgment on that one. Now, apparently Edmund, he's on the mast when he's up in the bird's nest when his sword goes all sting-like, and then he's on the dragon's head when the dragon's about to reach for him.
You mean the sea serpent?
Sea serpent at 157.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. This could be a good action scene.
Wait a minute. Wait, at 157, what are you looking at?
I'm looking at a shot of the sea serpent. It's a forward shot from the Dawn Treader. The sea
serpent's I didn't notice him there. He's like right on the edge of the prow.
Yeah.
I honestly didn't notice that.
Yeah, he gets around.
And we don't really know that's Edmund. I guess he would suppose, right?
It looks like Edmund. I'm looking at the HD version.
What the heck is he doing? And again, I don't like this kind of look at the dark island behind them. I just think that total blackness would have been creepier. Like what you don't see, like ask Steven Spielberg, what you don't see is usually scarier than what you do see.
Yeah, why is that sunlight coming in? That it just is kind of odd. Yeah. It does look unnatural, which I like. They did a good job making it look otherworldly.
Yeah, it does look kind of scary. And I like how that cloud's kind of backlit next to the light over there. But I just think that the idea of pitch blackness is so much scarier.
Mm-hmm.
But speaking of Lord of the Rings, talking about Sting, you know, things that are like Lord of the Rings, check out 159. That's Minas Morgul.
Yeah, it is. I was actually just thinking, yeah, compared to Minas Morgul.
And we're assuming, I suppose, this is when they put all the swords together and everything.
It's talking about a wake-up
extra
call.
Life, extra points. I don't know. I mean,
I wish my alarm clock did that.
Then we got them throwing spears and the big face-off with Skander against the sea serpent here, which we had that interview recently with Georgie Henley where she said, oh, Skander has kind of a Jack Sparrow stunt at the end of the film. And I didn't think she literally meant it's just like a scene from Pirates of the Caribbean 2 at the end where Jack Sparrow faces off against the Kraken.
Uh-huh.
I thought she just meant it's kind of a cool action moment. Yeah. But that's kind of what it looks like here.
So it does kind of, I mean, I don't think he's going to get eaten for the sequel, but I do kind of wonder how the sea serpent, I mean, okay, we know that the albatross is still there.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, maybe you know a lot more about this than I do, but I'm not really sure how they're going to get rid of the sea serpent.
I think I might have heard something about that. I don't really remember, and I would kind of like to forget at this point.
I've forgotten, so maybe you shouldn't tell me if it comes back to you, but I'm just kind of wondering, you know, how do they defeat the sea serpent? Because, and this is, again, something that's important because it's, the sea serpent is kind of seen in the book almost as a mundane enemy compared to a lot of their other adventures.
Well, it just makes it feel like, you know, oh, a lot of things happened to them over the course of that voyage. The fact that not every single event is vital to the story makes it seem more like a real voyage that happened, you know, and that was just one
right,
of the
events. Right, but depending on how you build it up, I mean, in the book, it's not really built up so much. The fact that Aslan doesn't save them doesn't necessarily mean – it doesn't give you the idea, yes, they survived on this voyage by their own bravado and their own skill and such like that. Whereas in the Dark Island, you know, the peril you feel is so intense that you realize, yes, you know, the fact that Aslan is the one who saves them does a whole lot for the story. So I'm just wondering how they're going to build up the sea serpent itself and how they're going to...
Seems like the sea serpent is a fear that's conjured by Edmund in the Dark Island, for one thing. I think that is more or less confirmed, I guess. That's probably the reason why there was that confusion about, is the sea serpent the witch? I think it's basically the Dark Island conjures the White Witch and it conjures the sea serpent. And I think the sea serpent is something from Edmund's nightmares, which would explain why he has to face off and defeat it here. And I guess one of the things that really bothers me about this scene is, just like the Lone Islands, this would be another example of a scene where, in the book, the whole point of it is that they win by not fighting. And here they are fighting to defeat it. It's like going the opposite of what it should be from the book.
Yeah, except I will say, I don't know how – I've thought about this, you know, doing the scene pretty close to the book, and I just don't know how it would work in a film.
Where they have to, like, push it over the edge and everything. I think they can make it work. And
then,
like, I think it's really intense when it's like, oh, we got to get over the mast. You know, get an axe. You know, I think that works really well. And I think, obviously, the other point behind this scene is to show Eustace actually doing something selfless. It doesn't do any good when he ruins Caspian's second best sword. And that was actually one reason why I thought maybe the whole dragon versus sea serpent thing isn't totally off base, because we would see dragon Eustace doing something selfless.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well,
but we'll see.
Yeah, we'll see.
And again, do you have any more thoughts here? Can I kind of go off on a little spiel?
You can go on.
Just for a second. I really feel like what they're trying to do here is, again, film is visual. So they want to come up with a visual way to talk about temptation, visual storytelling. So I think they've given us this mist, evil green mist that's unfathomable. And also temptation here. And I think the sea serpent and the mist are kind of sort of a visual way of showing that. And I get that. And if that's kind of their motivation, that's nice. But there's also such a thing as subtlety.
Mm-hmm.
This is definitely more visually driven, but it's not very subtle. I mean, it's much less subtle than anything in the book. I mean, to say, yeah, you see this big green black splotch over here and this sea serpent? Well, that's temptation. I mean, that's not the most subtle way you could. And Lewis is consistently very subtle.
Oh, yeah.
I just mean you don't have, like, you know, Reaper Cheap turning, you know, saying, "Oh, I just have this feeling that there must be something beyond this world. I just can't get away from it." And then, you know, "I just have this longing for my true home." He never says that.
Right.
It's just that if you kind of reflect and ponder Reaper Cheap's journey, then you're going to understand that. But it requires a little bit of retrospective analysis and interpretation. And I think I just feel like we're losing some of the subtlety. I mean, there's can't get much less subtle than a big giant monster jumping out at you in 3D.
How is that temptation? What's he tempted to do?
It's a manifestation of Edmund's fears, and the White Witch also comes from Edmund. And you get the sense that Edmund's trying to conquer something here. So
he
this
hates
is
snakes actually, back in England, and he wishes he lived in Ireland.
I hate snakes! I hate them!
I'll move to Ireland! I don't know.
But, I don't know, I just get the sense, I'm not sure how, but I think this is basically going to represent Edmund's temptation somehow, being the action climax of the film and the end of his arc.
Okay.
And, of course, you got the last shot. Presumably that Aslan Roar shot, which has been updated, is him undragoning Eustace, I suppose.
I presume.
Because it looks very similar, and you've got the Dark Island there in the background, the Dark Green Island.
Yeah. Well, and then they have the snow with the Don Treader. I don't know why they do that.
Gotta have the snow with the logo.
Because it raised $750 million before. Maybe it'll work this time. Well.
Right.
Okay, wrapping up, I mean, here, Glenfiddich, what do you... Going forward, we have a matter of days. I mean, you could count the number of days on your fingers and toes at this point. How are you... How do you plan on processing this as you go into the movie?
Well, that's one of the reasons why I've decided not to look at spoilers, is like how I plan to process it. Well, I plan to not process it. I plan to try to forget about it. Because ultimately, and I love, you know, recording videos and podcasts and stuff because it's fun to look back and say what were my initial reactions. But ultimately, they don't really matter because you see the film and all that matters. Like, we can speculate all day long, are the important themes going to come through? But who needs a trailer? Who needs pictures? Who needs any of this when you can just watch the movie? So my goal is really just to try to look at it on as level of a playing field as possible, which might not be that hard because –
it's so difficult.
Again, it might not be that hard because this is how it's been the past several weeks. There's this tug of war between what the footage is and reports are telling us, which mm-hmm. looks bad, and the general overall opinions we're getting about the film. And of course, we had a handful of Narnie Webbers, including Jim Phan, got to see the movie, and the opinions were mostly quite positive. I even saw one review over at NarnieFans.com where this guy said, "Yeah, I really didn't like the Seven Swords plot. That bothered me, but overall, I still liked the film." And mm-hmm. that's like, okay, well, here's someone who I'm not expecting to like the Seven Swords plot, assuming I'm not. Well, here's someone who makes that concession. Yeah, it wasn't good, but overall, the movie's still good. So I'm just kind of caught between looking at this footage and feeling really bad and feeling like they've really messed it up. But then again, the overall opinion seems really encouraging, so I'm not really sure what to make of that. And so I'm just this tug of war of is it going to be good or bad? So I don't think it's going to be that hard for me to go in pretty neutral.
Yeah, I guess at this point, I'm expecting the movie to work as a movie. I mean, I think that people who, maybe a general audience who have not grown up with the books, haven't read the books, will probably like the movie. I mean, it looks like they're pulling stuff together in a way that doesn't just seem ridiculous and cheesy and corny, like the first trailer made it look. So I think it will work as a movie, and from some of the comments, it sounds like it might be, just as a movie, the best movie of the three, in terms of acting and storyline and flow and just the feel you get. It sounds like it might be the best movie of the three, but looking at what they have changed, not just in adding stuff, like, you know, I remember when we were upset, "Oh my goodness, Edmund's trying to join the army?" but now, I guess I've seen where the filmmakers focus their attention. I'm just kind of wondering, as far as stuff coming, well, the stuff from the book comes through. You know, how strong does it come through compared to the rest of it? Because, you know, Lewis was such a good writer. You'd really have to do a whole lot to really remove a lot of those elements completely. Mm-hmm. So I guess I'm wondering, you know, I don't want to have to fish for them or feel like I'm lifting them up, say, yes, but if you do this and this and look at it this way, then this theme of longing still is, you know, I don't want to have to say, well, here, if you do this and justify it this way, then the book's themes are more important than what the filmmakers tried to do. Because, you know, you have comments like, well, Hollywood tried to do this and that. So I guess I'm kind of expecting this to be the worst adaptation, or at least the least faithful adaptation. What I don't want to do is come out, you know, pleasantly surprised and say, hey, that wasn't so bad, and then, you know, be too easy on it. Because, again, I have to hold them here to a higher standard than I did Prince Caspian.
And not even the standard of, is it as good as the first two films, but just the standard of, does it kind of live up to the book? Maybe not in terms of, is it just as powerful, but is the essence of the book really there? You know, and that's why I'm rereading Don Treader right now. And I just think it's really important that, you know, all these issues banging around in our heads and on the forum, hey, it's important. Before seeing it, let's just go back to the book and remember, hey, what's this all about?
Yeah, and that's why I'm going to be rereading it just before. And one guy said, no, you don't do that, because if you do that, then you'll be comparing it to the book, you know, with changes and things that they've made. You can't do that. You have to get it for the overall experience. And I said, look, man, I have read the book so many times, I will still be comparing it to the changes. The reason I'm rereading it is because I want to get the general overall feel of cover to cover, what was the Dawn Treader about? What did it provide me? And you know what?
It's not like there's a whole lot of details I'm picking up on right now. It's just getting a refresher of just like you're saying, the overall feel of it.
Yeah. So that's I really don't see how it could be I'll say this just realistically. Maybe I'll be surprised. I'm not, you know, writing it off as an adaptation. But as I'm looking at this, when I look at the Seven Swords and the emphasis on the climax, what are they building towards? I have to say, I don't see how this could be a better adaptation than Prince Caspian or Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. I just don't see how.
Not that either one was a perfect adaptation.
Right. No, that's my point. I'm kind of saying both of those were overall good, but flawed. Okay. And I actually, you know, I'm kind of with you. I like the Prince Caspian overall better as an adaptation, but and I have to say, okay, those were, you know, not good, not great adaptations, and I don't see this being great. I don't think it could. I don't see how it could be a great adaptation. So that's kind
of
where I am.
For me, the big thing is that there are clearly this trailer. There's a lot of things in the trailers that look so bad, but there are a few areas of the trailer where we know for a fact that it's misleading. So my hope is that, well, maybe there's a lot of areas that are also very misleading, but we don't have enough reports to know that they're misleading. So I'm kind of thinking, well, this whole thing, that's kind of how I reconcile this whole, you know, general thoughts being so good, but the details of the trailer looking bad. Like, well, maybe this trailer is just so unbelievably beginning to end misleading, because we know there's a few areas. So maybe it's like, maybe this is going to be a great film and is really going to capture the heart of the book, even if there's some things I don't like. And I'm kind of, again, in that kind of tug of war, the tension between overall thoughts and what we're seeing in the trailer, whereas before I was kind of leaning more towards the details looking bad. And I think I'm with a lot of Narnie Webbers on this one. I'm slowly starting to lean more towards, I don't know, maybe the overall is going to be good. So,
well, what I think is funny,
I don't know. I'm just kind of stuck in the middle somewhere.
Yeah, I think it is. I'm stuck really more on the negative side than I'm not stuck in the negative side, but I'm on the negative side. I can move to the positive side. It's possible. Yeah, what I do think is funny is how Jim Fan thinks that I'll like it, and she thinks you won't. Even though I have a more negative outlook at this point than you do. And Glumfuddle, I would have never expected for me to have a more negative.
I am not that pessimistic. It's just that I have the word glum in my screen name, so everybody remembers when I'm being negative.
Well, that's because they call you the nickname Glummy.
That's right.
Actually, that's me that calls you Glummy. But well, there's not really much more I'm going to say.
I'm basically done. I don't know what. I'm folding. I don't know what more I can say about this film. It's just time to go see it already. That's just kind of where I'm at right now.
Yeah. Well, and are you going to a lion party?
I don't think so. I don't think I'm going to be able to. Okay. I have some finals that week. I don't think I'm going to be able to.
Well, I will probably be at the Lion. This film comes out on the day that classes are not just over, but I mean, canceled on that Friday. So the it was just perfect for me. So I will probably – we plan to have a Lion party in Kansas City at the Legends Theater. And mm-hmm. me and my friends will probably do another sword play demo that we did 2 years ago for Prince Caspian. So if nothing else, we'll have a great time fighting with real weapons. So
yeah.
Glumfuddle?
All right. So this might be the last podcast before we see the movie. I would hope not. I hope we do just one
maybe.
More.
We'll I don't know what we would talk about.
Just in case, this is the last one. I mean, the past 2.5 years have been crazy. But ultimately, look, never mind all these issues, all the politics, all the arguments behind it. Just go into the movie, say, I like this book, want it to be a good film. Just go see the movie and see it for what it is. Then come back and rant about it after it's over.
I want to like the movie for the same reasons I like the book. That simple.
That's a good summary. And I want it to be a good movie. Mm-hmm. So we'll see.
Right.
So further up and further in.
Further up and further in.